will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I just can't take no pleasure in killing.
Just some things you gotta do. Don't mean you have to like it.
There's nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
Let her get away, Mommy.
Welcome to another edition of Horrifying My Friends. I'm horror host Trav. Joining me, as always, is producer Kate.
Hey.
And Becky fucking Hinton for her second episode.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome back.
I'm excited. This is another true crime edition of Horrifying My Friends. Horror slash neo-noir, I would say. What have you guys been up to, though? I want to get that out of the way first. What have you guys been watching? What have you guys been up to? I know Becky just got out of like a 45-minute McDonald's line.
Yeah, that was awful.
That was a true horror.
That was scariest thing.
No. Shake machines are off. Shake machines are off at 4 p.m. So that's how McDonald's rolls around here.
But yeah, Becky, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Well, just hanging with my kid and working. Nothing very exciting. What I've been watching is definitely not something that we would normally discuss on Horrifying My Friends.
You'd Maybe be surprised it is, because I think I've mentioned what you've been watching a couple times.
Married at First Sight?
Yes.
No, I just started that, but I'm in pretty deep.
Yeah, our listeners are going to get so sick.
Married at First Sight.
Let's talk about this show.
Well, that Chris is horrifying.
Yeah, if you're watching season 12... Chris is the absolute worst person they've ever had on the show.
What is he, just like a douchebag, or like
he's just human garbage, really?
He's mean, and he's a liar, and he's there's bad, like any man stereotype bad thing you could think.
Yeah, he's a misogynist. He's a liar. Yeah, he married this girl, like signed up for the show to get married at first sight to someone with the intention of supposedly staying married. Mm-hmm. But he was sleeping with his ex literally a month before, because it comes out on the show that his ex is pregnant. He's a hot mess.
And that's early. It just goes downhill.
That's the tip of the ice.
He's like, that's in the credits.
he's human trash. He's terrible. Anyway, but horrifying.
I'm just imagining like some woman like on a date with Leatherface or something, like the way you guys are describing this guy.
I mean, he definitely, I don't have a tough time. This is not a Married at First Sight podcast, but I think he ain't even cute.
It should be, though.
He ain't
even cute.
Yeah, he's not even cute. I could start a podcast about this show. In fact, I might. Anyway, I did watch something new that's not reality TV for once. It's not new at all. It's new to me, but it's called Flowers.
Okay.
There's two seasons of it on Netflix. It's a British show.
It's British. It's
all I can say is it's about this family, and it's all these different like relationship problems and mental health issues, and they're really eccentric and artsy, and it's also filmed in that way. It's written in that way that like everything is like very quirky and eccentric, and it was just a really fun watch. It's just two seasons of it so far, but
I always throw you off my British accent. It's British, isn't it?
That's the only like phrase Travis can say that, or I'm Michael Caine.
Isn't it? Yeah, I'm Michael Caine.
I did watch that Jared Leto movie that came out. I think it was on Netflix.
Little Things.
Oh,
yeah.
Little Things. Yeah. Okay. So I was actually going to bring that up. Let's bring that up a little bit later, though, because I think that has some similar themes for sure.
Yeah. It was kind of funny. I just chose to watch that. And then, it was like, huh.
So the movie that I brought Becky back for, I know the previous movie that we discussed was Silence of the Lambs. And So this is a little bit different flavor of like a serial killer kind of story. But this is Seven from 1995, directed by David Fincher. Film fans know that name from films like Zodiac, Fight Club, The Game, Social Network, Gone Girl. A true living legend. And someone that he really is, though, and someone that makes up. Like, I remember seeing The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, And then, like, Rose and I went to go see that in the theaters, and then I came home and I cried in Rose's lap for like 2 hours. I mean, that's a true story.
That movie does end so sad.
Oh my god! I literally.
Becky's like, haven't seen it. This is why we bring Becky on, is because we want to introduce her to some like the classics and like really, really, really good movies, because she just doesn't watch a lot of movies.
I don't. I don't watch TV or movies very often at all. I did love Fight Club.
Oh yeah,
I loved Fight Club.
Oh yeah,
I didn't realize that was the so that was the same director.
Yes, David Fincher. Yeah, he actually also created what was that show on Netflix?
Mindhunter.
Yeah, Mindhunter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he also is the showrunner for that, like creator of that show.
Haven't seen it.
So that it really,
it's very good. True crime, serial killers, FBI agents.
That is right up my alley.
Yeah, it's it's kind of based on the guys who started the whole like kind of profiling thing, and they.
So this is starring Brad Pitt. The prime Brad Pitt as Detective David Mills, Morgan Freeman as Detective Lieutenant William Somerset, Gwyneth Paltrow as Tracy Mills. Is this pre-Goop or post-Goop?
Pre-Goop, I think.
Okay. Kevin Spacey is John Doe. And I gotta say, like, it is very weird seeing him in movies. Like
now, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone listening knows the controversy around him. Well, yeah. He's a pedophile.
Yeah.
And I, that was when I was watching it, I was like, oh my gosh, he's doing a really good job with this role. And I like felt guilty complimenting his acting because of knowing who he is now.
Yeah. And I guess he was pulling from some real place in his brain.
Yeah. So it should be said.
Twist, sick and twisted.
Obviously, he's a sick motherfucker. But he is great in this film. Yeah, so we'll discuss that several times, probably coming up.
It's sad because I do like him in a lot of films, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
And Arlie Ermey as the police captain. I think he's, like, oddly really, really good in this movie. Like, that part when he's sitting at the desk and he's like, this ain't even my desk, and then hangs up the phone. music for this film composed by the great Howard Shore. Intro credits sampling Nine Inch Nails, Closer, always hooked me and perfectly set up the tone for what we were about to get into.
Do you know what he also scored?
What did he also score?
The Silence of the Lambs.
I could tell. I could totally tell. Uh-huh. As soon as the movie started, I could hear Nine Inch Nails. You know, I'm a product of the 90s. Well, product of the 80s, who grew up in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I was like, immediately I heard it and I was like, oh my gosh, of course.
Yeah, if you're into like movie scores and like the music in movies, soundtracks, what have you, like Howard Shore has scored probably the most big hits that I can think of. I'm sure there's someone else out there and I'm like gonna like...
Probably John Williams is probably the...
Yeah, John Williams and Howard Shore are one, like names I see all the time, like... For instance, Howard Shore also did Lord of the Rings series. Okay. All of those.
I was
those.
About to ask that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just so many.
You could feel it when it started. Like, this feels familiar.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Cinematography by Darius Kanji. I believe that's how you say that. And this was filmed mostly in L.A. I put that in there. I most of the time, I don't get into, like, where it was filmed and stuff. But I was like, this movie's got to be filmed in Seattle because it's like always raining and shit. But that'll come up in my fast facts. But it was actually filmed in L.A., which I thought was kind of cool.
I kind of thought it was supposed to be New York.
It is. I think it's supposed to be New York.
And the city is never like, I think they did that on purpose.
They don't say it.
Because it's like, yeah.
I guess probably because of the subway, like shaking the apartment. I was like assuming New York.
New York, or I guess maybe they could have been in Chicago, but to me it's probably New York, just because back in the 90s, New York was not the place it is now.
Yeah, yeah. It's, in terms it went of all like, Disney-fied and
how,
shit like
how
that.
Gritty and dangerous a lot of parts of New York. Now it's like so expensive to live there that they're pushing all that out, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, synopsis. Two detectives, a rookie and a veteran, hunt a serial killer who uses the seven deadly sins as his motives. Okay, my connection. This one, like many others, I was introduced to by my brother. He actually had the rare 7-issue comic book series. This is a special note. If any one of the listeners has that comic book series, hook your boy up. not sure what Bub thinks about 7 now. I know he likes to keep his thrillers and horror separate. But to me, 7 is an example of the neo-noir horror done like perfectly. After
explain
watching
neo-noir.
So neo-noir, we've covered a few on here. I would say like Lost Highway, Angel Heart. Noir was a film like kind of category back in the day of like it's always in the shadows and this guy's like smoking and he's got and a hat on and
it's a detective aka a dick, which they also I think they throw that around in this film. The SWAT team calls them dicks.
It's usually a killer on the loose or something like that. It's just a harken back to the old days of cinema, like 40s and 50s and these kind of movies.
And the movie was shot very dark.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Like half the time you're almost squinting to kind of like figure out what they're seeing or, you know.
Oh, yeah. So after watching, like, and keep in mind, this was after, this was during the midst of Brutal Trav. Brutal Trav is a character that we bring up multiple times on the show.
Pretentious Trav.
Yeah. Pretentious Trav with the, just the chin beard and that's it. Like, I only had that at
the
that chin, point.
The little strip.
Yeah. Yeah. Trav goes out after watching this to Barnes & Noble and buys a copy of Paradise Lost, and I walk around like a deep and complicated student. Fast facts. All of John Doe's books were real books written for the film. They took 2 months to complete and cost $15,000. That seems like a good job on a film for Heath and I. Can you imagine that, though, like being that guy that created all those books and shit?
Oh, all the notebooks? Yeah, yeah, with all those like crazy ramblings of manifesto.
That would be fun, though, to put those together.
But like when when someone reads them, do you get like, I don't know, put into an institution?
Probably.
Yeah, I'm sure that, I don't know, what happens to them when a movie wraps? Do they just like put it all in a storage room and be like, oh, or do they have to auction them off?
It's got to, Fincher probably owns some of them. Yeah, they probably auctioned
them. I bet they auctioned them, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Well, if anyone knows.
Brad Pitt has a few, or maybe Kevin Spacey.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah, Kevin Spacey's probably used them a couple times or something. Brad Pitt fell, actually, during the filming scene when Mills chases John Doe in the rain. Pitt's arm went through the car windshield, requiring surgery. He actually, like, severed a tendon or something. So ooh, this actually caused problems with filming. During several early scenes in the film, you can see his hand, like, one of his hands in his pocket, where he's, like, kind of hiding his arm cast and shit. Or, like, a cast that was on his arm.
Interesting. I want to watch it again just to see.
Never noticed.
The film's brooding and dark look was achieved through artificial rain machines on set and a chemical process called bleach bypass. The silver in the film stock was not removed, which deepened the dark, shadowy images in the film. David Fincher said that he wanted someone who's incredibly skinny, around 90 pounds, to play Victor. When Michael Reed McKay auditioned, he weighed 96 pounds, and Fincher joked that he needed to lose a little weight to get to the part.
Oh, God. So for anyone who doesn't remember who Victor is the sloth victim.
Yeah.
He's the one that, for a year, John Doe tortured, strapped into a bed, starved him, and tortured him in all kinds of ways, mm-hmm. and he ended up being like, gosh, so that was freaky, like, looking. Like,
yeah.
I'm getting ahead of myself, but anyway.
Okay, last note. With Seven comes a case of horror on screen versus implied horror. To this day, people argue that they've seen the version of the film where it shows the head in the box at the end. Spoilers. But no one, of course, has actually seen that. Like, it was always implied horror, and you kind of feel that fucking head being in there, like, yeah, when you watch the scene. Speaking of that ending, the studio wanted to change it, but Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, and Fincher were all like, we're bouncing if you change it. So if you change it, we're out.
How'd Gwyneth Paltrow feel?
I'm not sure.
She okay with her head being in the box?
She was cut up in a box. So, Becky, thus concludes my notes. And what are your first reactions of this film?
It was really good. Very much enjoyed it. I couldn't help of comparing it to Silence of the Lambs, because that was my last assignment from you, which I also really it does kind of feel like, you know, I took a film appreciation class in college, and when I watch these movies, I kind of get back in that frame of mind. It's really fun for me to like kind of start picking it apart. But it was really good. I did love how dark they made it. I think the acting was phenomenal. Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman were a great team. They played their roles perfectly, which together went really well. It was so different to me, the way, because, you know, this is horrifying my friends, so I'm always prepared to see the head in the box, like, I'm like, oh God, what's gonna happen to me today? So it was really different to not, you didn't experience the crimes, you saw the aftermath of the crimes, which was really, really different than what I expected. I was kind of expecting it to be a little bit more, it was gruesome, like the knife. Lust.
So yeah, had a special contraption made with a knife on it. It's basically a strap-on with a knife.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was.
Sorry, I guess we should have had a trigger warning or something for this episode.
You didn't actually have to watch him essentially have sex with her with knives.
But yeah, to see the guy's reaction.
Yeah.
So in this scene that we're talking about, John Doe basically held a gun to a prostitute and a John. So it was just this probably dorky guy who pays for sex, you know, put a gun to his head, told him, put on this
suit.
It's like a suit strap on kind of thing, and it has a knife on it. And he made this man have sex with her. And she, of course, probably bled out. in no time. But yeah, it's a, like, you don't need to see that happen to be completely disgusted and horrified
right.
by it.
Right.
So I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was different in that way. I thought that I would be seeing more terrible things happening. So, which I'm kind of glad I didn't. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that I did compare it to Silence of the Lambs is in Silence of the Lambs, my heartbeat would like get going because there were some really intense, like the, you know, that last scene
in the basement,
in the basement and all that, mm-hmm. you know, you're like, I could hardly breathe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's not really as much of that except when what's in the box, but it's like, it's already happened. So you don't get that same feeling in your gut.
Of like, yeah.
Of what's going on. You're like, something bad happened, not something bad could happen.
Is Do you that, know what I mean? Is it so powerful in Silence of the Lambs because like Clarice, you're in the mindset and following her around and like you're coming from the viewpoint of Clarice and you're in the predators. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I mean, that powerful? Movie is shot that way, mm-hmm. that you are Clarice in a lot of angles, whereas this is not. You know, it's not shot that same way.
Yeah.
And even though Brad Pitt is like a rookie and stuff, and it is very similar, he's still like this gruff, like out of control police, not out of control, but like he's more gruff than Morgan Freeman and stuff. And like,
he's still trying to prove himself.
Yeah.
Like he has this chip on his shoulder and he's still trying to prove himself. But Morgan Freeman's about to retire. He's like,
yeah, when I look at the two characters, the two main characters, Somerset and Mills. So Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt.
Which is actually all I'm going to call them.
Yeah.
That's all I do on this show, yeah.
I see Morgan Freeman's character. He's obviously this veteran. He's been doing this for more than 30 years. Detective who has just seen so many horrible things. And they do a great job of, in this movie, I think, and this is one of my first impressions, of having a balance between like the kind of the procedural that you're watching, like procedural cop stuff, and character buildings where you just get little snippets of what has happened in their life. And you're not just seeing them as like how they're acting now. You see what makes them the way they are now. But he's essentially this, he's about to retire. He has supposedly 7 days. He's just apathetic, but which is ironic because his issue with humanity is he's seen all these horrible things his whole career, that he is frustrated, and he's just not really frustrated. At this point, he's ready to give up on humanity and society, right? He's ready to go out in a cabin, wipe his hands clean of the world and people because he's so sick of seeing all these horrible things happen and people just be so, again, apathetic and just tolerant of it.
He's tired.
Yeah, he's seen the worst of what people do day in and day out, and he's just like, people don't care about one another anymore. Like the story he told, a man was mugged in the street and the guy didn't, you know, he's down, he's beaten up, and the person mugging him couldn't just leave it at that. He stabbed him in the eyes with a knife, you know? And it's like, that's the kind of stuff that he is seeing so much that has really just made him as apathetic about humanity as he thinks everyone else is.
Yeah.
He's jaded, you know? And then Mills is this young cop. He's been a detective for what, like 5 years, he said. Yep. And he's coming in, you know, essentially to replace Morgan Freeman's character. But you're seeing how Morgan Freeman and becomes like a mentor to him. And he's this intellectual versus kind of the brawn of Mills. He acts first, asks questions later.
He's like
later.
This hothead.
Yeah, a hothead.
Do you know what it reminded me of?
And he's got so much hubris, you know, and like pride and hubris. And it's just like, chill out. It's not cute.
Do you know what it reminds me of is when an older generation talks about a younger generation in the workforce. I have to say, like, when people talk about, oh, working with millennials.
Yeah.
Now I think that's kind of transitioning. But that's kind of what I thought of, is he's that stereotypical young generation coming in, trying to prove himself, having no patience of, like, you know, taking his time. And I think as young professionals, we've all been there a time or two, right? Where we're just, like, a little overzealous. And it's like, just sit back. You'll get there.
Or it's like,
okay.
Calm down, hothead.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it weird how, like, that shift is beginning? Like, we're all of a sudden becoming that older generation now.
The mentor generation.
Yeah.
And
like, memes and shit that we're beginning to see.
I'm so glad to be there, personally.
To pass the torch.
I don't like being the young person, you know, faking it till I make it. I'm very comfortable knowing what I'm doing now.
I'm a little older than you guys already, so but yeah, it is kind of interesting to see it shifting.
So one of the things that I had like about these characters is like, and I loved the beginning scene, like this movie opens and you're kind of it's setting you up as like you're seeing, you almost like, would you agree that this movie, you're seeing this movie through the eyes of Somerset, almost like Somerset is like kind of the main character?
I think he's the person you're following. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's his journey and it's his voice. I think you hear first.
Yeah. Well, I just love like opening up in his apartment and you just, it's showing him getting ready in the dark and it's all quiet in his apartment. And outside you can just hear like the rain and police sirens. And it's like you said, this, I think this movie does a brilliant job of like showing the effect of like all this stuff on a police officer, on a good police officer like Somerset. Mm-hmm. All the other really police, like that early scene when he's in that crime scene and it's like the wife shot the husband or something, or it's like a double homicide or homicide suicide or something, and he's mm-hmm. like, did the kid see it? And that other detective is just like, what the fuck matter? Yeah, does it matter?
Right. And that's, they do this a lot in this film. There's mm-hmm. that scene, and then they sprinkle it all throughout, all mm-hmm. these instances that reinforce Somerset's view on the world and on humanity,
mm-hmm.
really hammer that like apathetic, unempathetic kind of viewpoint. And I think it's really cool that the whole arc of this movie, it's his journey from being ready to give up to finally at the end, what does he say? He says, oh, he quotes Hemingway and he says, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part, which means he probably does stay on in his career a little bit longer to mm-hmm. help solve crimes and do the right thing and be that person that's what you want humanity to be like. But
so, Becky, you brought up, sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay.
Becky, you brought up The Little Things earlier. I think it's called The Little Things, right? Or just Little Things on HBO.
I don't remember.
Yeah, it's one of those.
Yeah.
But they deal with like similar themes and stuff. But how did you like feel like this stacked up as far as like themes and stuff? Because I felt like they dealt with similar themes in that movie of like the old cop and this new hotshot played by Rami Malek. And like, I just felt like this movie did it so much better though and more clear.
You think Seven did?
I think so.
I agree. I think Seven had a lot more intensity mm-hmm. that I think lacked in Little Things. I enjoyed that Little Things movie, but this was definitely a lot more intense. Mm-hmm. They did a better job of drawing you in, I think. Little Things, I thought, could kind of, it was a little, I don't want to say boring because it wasn't completely boring, but it was a little flat in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
So the events that happen in Seven obviously keep you more engaged than what I was in The Little Things.
I found myself caring more about the characters in this, in Seven, I should say, than in The Little Things. Because they shroud so much of the veteran detective and honestly the young detective's past and their just about their lives. They shroud it all in kind of a mystery or in, you know, all this unknown, unspoken stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this film, you get a ton of character building scenes, but also just every scene that's procedural where there's action, you're also getting little stories as snippets put in or little glimpses into their character just in the like their response, the way they respond to things and all of that, whereas The Little Things tried to do it but just not as well, I think.
No, but I totally agree.
Just the scene in itself, the scene where they're in the office, you know, the young guys come in, Mills has come in, and you know, Somerset's not quite moved out, and so they're sharing the office, the phone rings, and it's Mills' wife, Tracy, and you just hear him talking with her on the phone, like trying to be like, no, I'm not going to do that, whatever. And he finally gives in because, you know, she's the boss. Uh-huh. And hands the phone over. He hands the phone over to Somerset, and you only hear his, like, the guy's side of this. You don't hear Tracy, but you just know that she's being like this kind, warm person that's just like, you're coming to dinner. And then the following scene is them at dinner. You start to see their walls come down, you know, mm-hmm. with each other, the two detectives, because they both had their backs up about each other mm-hmm. for a while there. And Tracy's this like character who you just love. Whatever you think about Gwyneth Paltrow, put it out of your head.
Yeah, she's very
but
good.
But Tracy,
in this. Yeah.
Tracy as a character is someone that you want to know, and you think like you just get a sense that she is this good, kind-hearted person, bit naive, but like she knew what each of them needed, and she knew especially what her husband needed.
Yeah.
And I just thought that whole dinner scene, and with the train coming through, and them being a little embarrassed, and then Somerset kind of just laughing and breaking the tension. I don't know. I just love that scene so much. It's honestly one of my favorites.
That's my favorite scene in the movie.
I actually, going back to like when she calls, I think this is the time where they're like, they adjust that phone for like a solid 30 seconds, like moving it back and forth. Cause Mills is so uncomfortable. He's like, you know, like, I don't know if it was just being in that office or like, you know, being in Somerset space. And I thought that was a really good scene to, because he does have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. It was a good time to like see that like he had some insecurities and that, you know, to he feel just, to feel him.
Yeah, he just wants to be respected.
Yeah.
And he clearly knows he's young, you know, in the profession, and he just doesn't want anyone to allude to him being young. And I think we can all relate to that. Like being young in our careers, just not wanting to be treated like you don't know anything.
Yeah.
Or to be treated like someone knows better than you.
Yeah.
But. Yeah. And she also like knows, like, and you alluded to this, but she knows her husband, like she knows her husband's being standoffish at times and shit. So like when she answers the door and it's Somerset, she's like, William, I'm what's her name? Tracy. And this is my husband. Like she like formally introduces them.
Right.
Like,
I find myself doing that all the time with my husband. He never introduces people, but she's like, I don't actually know your first name to Somerset. Mm-hmm. And he says, William. And then she's like, meet David. And then they're like, oh.
Well, it makes, it goes with another theme. Cause it's like, they're not just detectives. They're also people. Mm-hmm. So it's like they haven't met as people yet. So that's why I love that scene so much. And that's kind of the beginning when they start like being able to work together and actually like putting shit together. Like they get that first big clue of like the blood around the woman's eyes, like his wife's eyes and shit.
Yeah.
Like in that crime scene.
And that's it's a huge key scene. You're right. Because before they have dinner, Somerset is ready. He's like, I'm not getting involved in this case. I only have a few more days left before I retire. Pass it off to someone else. And he is just filling out his paperwork and biding his time. And then they have dinner. And by the end of dinner, they're looking at crime scene photos. And he is back in and he's committed to seeing it through, which,
you know, it's big for the plot. And he also sees this, like, this young kid, like you said, like this young guy, I should say. And he sees that he is working, no matter if he's got spark notes, whatever. Like, he's trying to get all, through all this shit.
No, they're cliff notes. Did you you guys have cliff notes in your years at all?
We had... Okay. Yeah, the spark notes. But cliff notes were just the other one.
Marquis de Sade. The one That's one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah. Cliff notes you had to buy back in the day, where spark notes, you could get them bootleg online. You could find
people. See, we couldn't always get things online. So, like, we definitely had cliff notes. Yeah. That was a real... So, I was dying when I saw cliff notes, because no one's talked to me about cliff notes in a really long time.
Now kids just, like, watch a YouTube video.
Well, I know. Yeah. Not to get, like, old fart on you, but, like, you know, kids have it so easy. They just go on the internet, you know? So it was so funny to me to see the cliff notes scene. It just really made my heart happy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's another factor is he's like, he's seeing this young cop really try to work on this thing and shit, like trying to dive into these like old classic books and shit that this killer's taking like little stuff from. And so Somerset sees that and he's like, all right, like I'm in. Like, you know what I mean? Like he knows this guy.
I also have this feeling that, you know, obviously Somerset, he never settled down. And I think he regrets that. I think that he wishes he could have had a family and he could have maybe did a little less career and a little more balance. Mm-hmm. So I think when he meets Tracy, he's like, I want this for him. Like, I want him to have this life. I don't really want him to end up jaded like me.
Well, I think he knows that the job is going to jade Mills anyway.
Right.
But he's already lived this life where he had an opportunity where his girlfriend or wife at the time was pregnant. He basically wore her down into having an abortion. And he tells this story to Tracy because Tracy has revealed that
I'm confused about that because he does seem like he wants it for Mills, but yet he is glad that he says that it was the right decision for him.
Yes. He said, I know I made the right decision, but not a day goes by that I don't wish I'd made a different choice. So he knew he was right. Like his sort of the ethical reason for and emotional reason why he didn't want to have children, he still stands by because, you know, humanity can be horrible and the world can be scary. Mm-hmm. But by saying, like, I wish I had made a different choice, I think he does regret what he did. And you're right, Becky. I think he does wish he had a family and something.
A balance.
Something to bring light and back into his life, you know. Yeah. because he literally is like lives alone. He clearly reads a lot of classics. He's got a lot of time. And he's this intellectual. He just goes to bed to the sound of his metronome. And it's just really depressing, honestly, to see those scenes of him by himself.
Another scene that I really, really love is like, and this isn't, I'm going to have a whole new batch of favorite scenes. So this isn't the favorite scene section yet. But another scene that I feel like shows kind of like the human side of these detectives is when Somerset goes to the library to like study books, and he's like kind of like throwing like little digs at the guys upstairs, and they're throwing digs back, and mm-hmm. they're just like, they're up there playing poker, and he's like, all these books in this library and you guys are playing poker, you know, all yeah, this shit.
I like that scene a lot.
He said like no culture or something, and he's like, how's this for culture, and he turns on that Bach song or something. I love that scene though, man.
And I also loved how they're like, you're gonna miss us when you're gone, and he's like, I know, I probably will. I just think those little moments really give you a sense of them as a person, and how like, as much as people are giving him shit for retiring, like, he's loved. He's absolutely loved in that, in the whole, like, just everywhere.
Yeah. I think we all know someone like that, though, with the hard exterior that you know, like, inside there is, like, a really kind, loving person, but they just put out, like, this wall.
Mm-hmm. And do you guys think, like, as far as, like, Somerset's character goes, do you think that, because isn't it brought up at one point in the movie, like, if he was meant for this kind of job, or, like, the boss says, like, you were meant for this kind of work, and he says something, like, kind of opposite that or something. So, but I think he's, like, a good example of, like, the kind of person that it takes to be a cop. Like, he's, like, a good-natured person and shit. Like, I don't know, though.
So I think you're kind of getting at a theme here, or mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a theme or if it's just, like, the scene you're talking about where they're in the office and he's just like, no, take me off this case. Like, I don't want to be involved. Like, give me easy shit, basically. Mm-hmm. The captain or whoever he is just like you said, you were made for this kind of work. And he's just like, but I'm done.
He wants to ride off into the sunset.
Let him go. So basically saying you're chosen for this work. But it's a very interesting and cool allusion that they make to that scene at the end in the car when they have John Doe in the back seat and they're driving. And John Doe's talking about how he was chosen, you know, he was chosen by God or whatever. And Mills says, well, if you were chosen for this work, you wouldn't get so much pleasure out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's that really,
was a
it's,
really
yeah,
good scene.
It's really all of, like, you would feel burdened by being chosen for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he feels that himself. Like, he is good at this. He's a good detective. He's meant to be doing this, but he doesn't get pleasure from it. It's been a weight on him his entire life. And I think you see the difference in their characters. I think there's a lot of similarities with John Doe and I think it's purposeful too, mm-hmm. and Somerset's character. They both talk about how they have this same problem of all these horrible things happening in the world. John Doe actually says that all these horrible things happen and we just tolerate it, which is just a different words to describe exactly what Somerset was saying earlier in the movie about apathy. And so they have the same problem, but obviously they deal with things differently.
Mm-hmm.
John Doe comes into his life, you know, I think for a reason, if you follow this whole, you know, the kind of underlying faith themes in it too, but comes into his life and for a reason to turn around his mindset.
Mm-hmm. So Becky, what did you think about the themes and stuff? Like, kind of like along the lines of what Katie's saying, like, what did you think about the dichotomy or the similarities between John Doe and Somerset and like these themes of like this dark world and shit and how they view the world?
Tell us how you view. Where are you on the spectrum of, I guess, Mills, who is like, I refuse to accept what you're saying about humanity and people. I can't accept that about, like, he's like, no, people are good. He's the opposite end of the spectrum, I think.
You're asking me which way I feel?
Where do you fall on the spectrum?
Yeah.
I would say I fall more towards Mills, that I refuse. I'm an optimist and I refuse to believe that, you know, the world is just full of bad.
Uh-huh.
I think, unfortunately, the bad is what we tend to focus on. Mm-hmm. But I like to think somehow that, you know, the world is actually good and that humanity is good. There's just some real bad seeds out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I agree with you. I mean, a lot of people think I'm a pessimist because I'm like pragmatic and realistic, but that doesn't make me a pessimist. I am pretty optimistic about people and humanity. I recognize there's very negative instincts that all people and humans have.
Katie's John Doe. That's the
no. But I was gonna say when we think about what gets reported in media, it's almost never like proportionally. It's all the bad. If it bleeds, it leads. It's negative stories and about humanity. And if you pay too much attention to that, or if you're like these guys, you're literally the one solving the crimes, your outlook on life could become pretty bleak.
Well, and they did allude to that. Mills was somewhere else before he transferred to this district where things are just all bad. Because if you think of, I mean,
because he came from upstate where there's not as much stuff. Yeah. And he is attracted to the devastation of the city. Right, you know, he wants to be in the mix.
So, of course, if you have been doing this in this bad place for so long, you can't help but get jaded, you know. But Mills isn't coming from that. He's coming from, I've worked homicides, but how many and how often?
Yeah.
He versus wants to be how many, you know, are happening here where he is now.
Yeah. He wants to be this white knight that's going to come into the city and really clean it up, you know.
And even if he didn't end up how he was, how he did, because obviously I don't think he's going to be able to be that white knight, obviously. But even if this wouldn't have happened, at some point, there's a good chance he would have ended up more like Somerset, more jaded and more, you know.
You never know. If his wife lived, you know, spoiler alert, she died. She's murdered. but if she lived and he had his child and like
they probably would have moved back upstate.
Their high school sweethearts, and maybe they would have had a kid, and, you know, kids do something. Not saying everyone should have kids, like. It's your choice, but you and I are mothers, you know, and when you see how much light they are, like, kids are just light. And
they really are. And I was someone who I think we both kind of are. We weren't really sure that I'll speak for myself. I wasn't sure that I really wanted kids.
Like, no, I was the same. Yeah.
I was like, my life's pretty cool. I like it. You know, I never imagined how much, you know, my daughter's name is Julia, but I never knew how much she would come into my life and just make it so fun and bright.
Yeah. And I think even if you do a really depressing job like they do, if you had your child at home, it would remind you of like why you're doing it.
Absolutely.
And like you would hopefully be able to have much more happy, light moments in your life to balance out all that darkness. But by choice, Somerset chose to not have any of
that's
that.
True.
He divorced his wife. He chooses to live alone. He hasn't tried to get, as far as we know, he doesn't really try to have people in his life. He's kind of a loner.
I don't think he got divorced. I don't think he was ever married. He says, like, I was almost married.
Close.
I was close. So he was, even at a young age, so I'm kind of going against what I already said, but even at a young age, he was very guarded. He was like, you know, he almost wouldn't, I feel like he knew that light could be there, but he was like, I can't admit it. Like,
or he was scared of losing it because he has seen so many horrible things happen to other families and people.
The one thing this movie did leave, I had so many more questions about, as much as it, because it was giving you this character build, but I want to know more about them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I have so many more questions. And even about some of the crimes and things, because, you know, like the crimes weren't all like the bad person ended up dead. It was like sometimes opposite, you know, that just because you were the one who committed the sin doesn't mean you're going to be the one who ends up dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I thought really was an interesting way of doing, because if it would have been a lot more predictable, I think, if they did make the sinner the one who always died, but instead of doing that, he kind of mixed it up. I just thought that was really interesting. The sin is what the victim was. It's like the people weren't. It was the actual sin was the victim, which is really a weird, it's just a weird thing, a weird way of going about it. It's a lot less black and white, I guess. Because the first couple, it was like gluttony and greed. It was the sinner. So that's where you think it's going to go. You think it's just going to keep being that. Nope.
And then he flips the script. Yeah, the sloth guy was just like, he's still alive in the end, but like so just a shell of a person. I don't know. Let's talk about this. So the last two of the seven deadly sins, which is that's why this movie has its name, were envy and wrath. And obviously this is all John Doe's, literally everything has been orchestrated. Not one thing is a mistake. And his goal in the end was always to take all of Mills' like will to be a good person and to have control and be someone more like Somerset, who knew the right thing to do in that moment was not to go off the handle and shoot him, but to his sin is wrath. He's always the one to act and, you know, kick the door down, to verbally abuse the guy in the back seat. You know, he, wrath is kind of his thing. It's his sin as John Doe sees it. And his goal was always to bring that out and ultimately to die a martyr, because he knew that if he did that, Mills would shoot him and he would become this messiah that will bring all the other lunatics. You know, they say not to, we'll get to that in a minute. He's a very smart lunatic, I'll say, but to bring all the other crazies out of the woodwork, to be like, oh, look at him. And they want him, his goal is to become this idol for people, mm-hmm. to then want to be more like that. And what I still don't kind of understand is John Doe said, I'm envy.
And I didn't see that.
I don't think he envied Mills at all.
I agree with you.
This normal life, I don't think. And maybe the comic, you said it's based on comics.
It's not based on a comic. They just made comics to go away.
After it, yeah. Oh, well, maybe we should, if you get your hands on those, like, I really would like to know, like, what we can learn about John Doe that made him this way.
That's, you
know,
what I'm saying. I have so many questions and I want to know so much more.
Yeah. Is it true? Like, is it true that something, you know, has made it so that he, you know, other than being a psychopath, that has made it so he can't have the kind of life that Mills had, where he married his high school sweetheart and had a baby on the way and had a good career? And,
well, because he's wealthy,
super handsome, and, you know,
yeah, like, I mean, he's wealthy, so he has means, you know, like, but, how did they never went into how he had these means, did he?
No, they just said he's independently wealthy. But yeah, that's my thing, is like, it never lined up to me that envy was his thing, or like, it seemed like, for someone who is so calculated with literally every single sin and every single horrific scene he would set up, it's like, for him to just kind of have a throwaway of like, yeah, I was, quote, you know, it's almost like quotes, like this sarcastic, yeah, I was so envious of what you had. It's time for, you know, it just didn't make sense.
He went there to kill her. Mm-hmm. He brought Mills in, and then he went there to kill her.
Yeah, I think he did messed up things. So I think he went in, because he alluded to the fact that he obviously broke in, held her hostage. I think he might have raped her. But it seemed like he tried to play house with her, and she begged for her life.
Did he say he raped her? He said something.
He said, I tried to play house or something like that.
Yeah, play house, yeah. Play husband. And, like, my mind went there, but they didn't say. Maybe not. But, I mean, ultimately, that was, like, maybe that's where the envy came from. Maybe that was his sin, is that he went in with the intention of maybe just killing her, but he, like, couldn't help himself.
Do you think he was saying that Somerset was envy? Like, envy?
No.
Okay.
Because he said himself, like, I'm the envious one. I envy your life. But he said it in a sarcastic way. Like, he didn't really mean it.
I just couldn't buy that from him.
Yeah. So that's why I want to, I mean, not to belabor this anymore, but I feel like maybe those comics that they wrote give more insight into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the same guys didn't write it or whatever. So I'm not sure how they go on with that. But yeah, that whole last scene is just like incredibly powerful, because he's like, when he talks about the, you know, the head in the box and the unborn child and stuff, and then like Brad Pitt's face, you can just see his face, and it's like so fucked up looking and so hurt and stuff, and he's just like, oh, he didn't know. Like, yeah. Just the way that Kevin Spacey delivers that line is like brilliant. Like,
if you want to see incredible acting, just watch the final act of this movie. It's just, yeah. They do such a good job.
And not to bring back Silence of the Lambs, but he did in that scene remind me a lot of Hannibal Lecter. Mm-hmm. Like, the way he was able to like speak, I don't know how else to say that, but the way he articulated,
yeah,
really reminded me.
Yeah, very cold and calculated and yeah. Stuff. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So I mean, this is what I was saying about that. Well, I'll get to it later. The whole the word lunatic. So Mills calls the killer, before they know who he is, a lunatic. And Somerset makes a point to say, it's dismissive to call him a lunatic. Don't make that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the car ride, when, you know, in the end they have John Doe, he's given himself up and they're going to quote unquote find these bodies. And that whole scene, I encourage you, Becky, to go back, even if you just look it up on YouTube, and watch that car ride scene again now that you know what happens in the end. Mm-hmm. And maybe you kind of already saw it coming just because culturally we know what's in the box is something that people say all the time.
What's in the box?
Missed me.
It's missed you. You didn't see it coming?
No.
Wow.
I mean, I didn't.
You're a rare, you know, a rare little diamond.
I didn't know a box was coming. I think once the box got there, I started to get skeptical.
Uh-huh.
But yeah. In the car ride there, I had no idea there was going to be a box.
Oh, well. That's awesome. I wish I could relive that twist myself. But if you watch the whole car ride scene and really listen to the dialogue in that scene, it takes on a whole mm-hmm. a whole other feel.
Well, I know he was like being so pretentious.
Well, no, he was being precise.
Yeah.
He was very precise in the words that he would say and like how he would be like, oh, well, yeah, you're going to.
Oh, it's a big thing. Yeah. Something big's happening.
Right. And so, like, Mills is just this, like, he's so no clue. He thinks we got the guy. We're going, takes everything at face value. He's like, we're going to get these bodies. You're caught. You're donezo. And you can tell Somerset, who's driving, the whole, like, he's skeptical of all of this, and he has been the whole time. And he's just like, he knows something's coming. He just doesn't know what. And that gets back to their different mindsets and their different way they think about the world. As Somerset's like already jaded. He's like, something else is coming bad. And Mills is like, yay, we did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The way that he's working the two detectives and the way that they're like both allowing him to work them. Like, there's several times that Somerset looks over at Mills because Mills is like cussing at him or like saying like, you're yesterday's news, you're fucking your last week's flavor of the month and shit like that. Like, he's really, really getting, like, you can tell that John Doe is really, really getting to him. And Somerset kind of like looks over at Mills like several times, like, dude, like, level, you need to level yourself.
Yeah. Because... like, you don't need to win every argument. Yes. You need to just like,
you don't need to engage everything with this guy.
Yeah.
It's so foreboding and eerie when you watch it the second time, when you know exactly what John Doe knows.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And just see Mills still not knowing it. Like, it's, you got to watch that scene again.
Another movie, and this is just like a random bit of trivia and stuff, but another movie that takes similar themes to this is The Dark Knight. Like, you remember Dark Knight with Heath Ledger's Joker?
So guess what?
What? You've never seen that movie? Holy shit. So in that movie, he wants to corrupt like this white knight or whatever. Like, he actually wants Batman to kill him. And this is kind of like a Joker Batman thing. It's like, if you kill me, then I win because you're corrupted. You're no longer the perfect white knight kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you're corrupted, you're done if you kill me. So
it shatters his worldview, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what this guy did
for sure. I've always wanted to see that movie. I don't know why I don't sit down and watch these, but I have not seen it.
The date night.
I don't think Danny's seen it either.
Danny would like it.
Yeah, Danny would fucking love it. So anyway, so before we get like our final reaction and stuff, I kind of want to see, and you mentioned it several times, like Silence of the Lambs and stuff.
Yeah.
So comparing this one and Silence of the Lambs, and I know they're like different kind of flavors and stuff. Where did this one fall short to Silence of the Lambs for you?
I don't want to say it fell short because I don't think that's giving it enough credit because it was, that makes it sound like I didn't like it because I loved it. I think you get me, Travis, you give me movies I'm going to love. But where it didn't get me feeling as intense is the how it's an after the fact, you know, like you see everything afterwards, you don't see it during. So it didn't get my heart pumping as much, you know, like you didn't see in Silence of the Lambs, you watch, you know, the kidnapping and things like that. Like from the get go, you have some like, oh, and maybe and.
You actually are with the killer more.
Right, in Silence right. Of the Lambs. So you're, yeah. So this is from a different perspective. And so you're seeing it all after the fact. So it's a little bit different in that way. So that's probably why I didn't like it quite as much is because it didn't get my blood pumping quite as much.
That's fair. Oh, that's fair.
You know, but it was really good. That's not to say it wasn't a good movie and I wouldn't watch it again. Yeah.
So give me a favorite scene and then your overall rating.
Okay. Favorite scene. I mean, am I allowed to use the last scene? Because that last,
absolutely,
that last. I mean, that's it. That's the movie. Like, I mean, it's all.
It's what makes it iconic.
It
for
all
sure.
builds it to there. That last scene was awesome, and to watch Brad Pitt or Mills' character just like deteriorate before your eyes. It was pretty amazing, you know. So that was pretty awesome, and I think Kevin Spacey playing that role. I mean, all three of them. Kevin Spacey played that role. so well. And Somerset too, you saw like when he just broke inside, like, yeah.
Oh,
on.
When he sees that box.
Like, come on.
Because he had come to love Tracy too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that one.
He felt very tender for her, and he's not mm-hmm. a tender. He doesn't let himself be tender for anybody, and he yeah. was tender for her. Mm-hmm. So just like the three of them in that last scene and all of their acting combined into one scene.
Oh, I thought that was devastating.
It was a phenomenal job, though. I mean, they yeah. did a great job. So I remember rating Silence of the Lamb 4.7 because you guys ripped me real hard about it. Because I guess probably 4.7 is like really a 5 for me. So I'd probably give this like a 4.2.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So still a very solid going up to that 5, you know.
Okay.
And just to, for example, I would probably give that like the Little Things or whatever it's called, probably like a 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fair.
Katie?
I already mentioned my favorite scene, which is the dinner, office to dinner scene where the walls come down, all that. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. I've watched this probably 5 times, I think, now, and loved it every single time. I notice a little something new in the scenes or a little line here or a line there that I never noticed before. And there's a lot of detail, too, just like in the crime scenes. And yeah, it's just... It's one of those movies that keeps on giving.
So one scene that we haven't mentioned, and I will mention it here before my rating, was the scene when John Doe gets out of the taxi and stuff, and he has those bloody fingerprint, like mm-hmm. fingertips. And he's like, detectives. And he's like, detectives!
Yeah. He did. And that was another area that reminded me of Hannibal Lecter, the way he like... Just the way he articulates, it was like very... When did Silence of the Lambs come out? Sorry.
90 or 91?
Yeah. Okay, so this was like a few years...
A little before, yeah.
No, so yeah, it was like a few 95. Years later, 7 came out. But I just felt like he played a lot of that same like...
Yeah.
Psycho.
Yeah, yeah, the really intellectual psycho. Yeah. I'm sure he took a little bit from that other performance.
Oh, for sure,
but
yeah.
Trav, I thought you would say that one of your favorite scenes was the one where detectives have arrived on the lust scene and they are coming... And they're, to Nine Inch Nails, like, is, like, blasting, and uh-huh. the music is blasting. There's all this red light, and it's just chaos and overstimulation of them, like, basically descending into hell, you know? I thought you would like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, in that whole movie, like, and I love that scene, but, like, this whole movie is, like, a descent into hell kind of thing. Like, yeah. another theme, like, the Dante's Inferno and stuff. But, yeah, like, ton of scenes in this movie that I absolutely love. This thing is, like, dripping with atmosphere that... is like quintessential what Travis loves, like this just rainy, like dirty dark. Look, yeah, just darkness everywhere and shit. I love that shit. But this is a 5 out of 5 for me. Like, I absolutely love this movie. You said you've seen it like 5 times. Same here. Like, I've seen it multiple times, and it gets almost stronger every time I watch it. But just the dichotomy of the two characters and pitted against this John Doe, and it's like just fantastic. Masterful movie, like, in mm-hmm. my opinion. One thing we didn't talk about is the fact that he disguises himself as the journalist and like is taking a picture, and he's like,
oh yeah, I think when I first saw that, I was like, they didn't put that journalist Ooh. In here for no reason. I bet that was the killer coming
so,
back.
I didn't find that out till I saw that picture, obviously, so I wasn't paying that close of attention. But did they actually show Kevin Spacey being, or was it
you
just...
You don't see his face.
You yes. just see, like, the hat and the coat.
The hat. And
that
the,
you see when he's running from...
He's wearing glasses of some kind, too. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you just see kind of shadows on his face. You don't...
Okay.
It's not clear it's him.
I mm-hmm. was curious, because after it showed that picture, I was like... I wonder if they showed that, but I didn't have a chance to go back and watch it a second time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, but anyway, so thank you for joining us, Becky.
Oh, glad to be here. That was awesome.
These are always a blast. I love the conversation with Becky. Like, I just love conversating with Becky about whatever, like anything, Goop, anything.
Let's not talk about Goop.
Anything. So, but yeah, thank you for joining us. As always, I have a book recommendation. So this week's book recommendation is Torso. A true crime graphic novel by Brian Michael Bendis. David Fincher was actually supposed to make this a movie, so there's no synopsis on the back. But anyway, this is about the torso killer in Cleveland, I think, during the 20s and 30s. They would just basically, like, once... What's his name? What was the guy's name that... Anyway, the guy that busted Capone, actually, after he wrapped up with Capone, he went to Cleveland and started investigating the torso murderer. And the torso murderer, he would leave, like, random torsos just, like, out, just, like, wherever.
Like, no head?
Yeah, no head, no legs, no arms, just a torso. Gross. And they never found any of the heads or whatever. And nobody ever knew who this guy was, but this is basically just a comic about the investigation and stuff. But yeah, I'll put the name of the investigator. He's a well-known investigator that busted Capone. But anyway, that's my recommendation of the week. Like I said, David Fincher was originally attached to direct that. I wish he would have made it. It would have been fucking amazing. But Kate, do you have anything else for the listeners?
No, just watch this movie again and again.
It was awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
Fuck yeah.
Thanks for coming.
And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Horrifying My Friends and on Twitter at HorrifyingMF. Bye. Horrifying My Friends.